So this talk is about using the tools of quantum field theory, which many of us know very well and love, and leveraging that to enable precision gravitational wave science. Okay, so talk is based on a number of works with collaborators. My collaborators include Clifford Chung at Caltech, Ira Rothstein at Carnegie Mellon, Zvi Byrne here at UCLA, Radu Raghavan at Penn State, Xiaoshen Shen at UCSD, Mao Zheng at Oxford, Naba Shah at Caltech, and Julio Paramartinez at Caltech, and finally, Michelle Roof, who will be a postdoc here at UCLA this fall. And we have other ongoing work, but the talk will focus on the broad pieces of the key ideas, okay? Of course, the motivation is this, this great discovery in 2015 of LIGO of gravitational waves, and the fact that this will continue. Currently, we have probably about 50 detections of mergers, and with more gravitational waves gravitational wave observatories planned, the data will keep going up, and we will get better and better data. In particular, third generation detectors will come also in a decade or so. And this really means that we are headed towards hopefully a precision era of gravitational wave science, where we have maybe 10 to the 6 mergers detected. That's a lot of mergers. And because of that data, we can learn so many things about astrophysics, cosmology, particle physics, and so on. Of course, one side of this is required theoretical predictions. And so there are decades of heroic effort translating Einstein's equations to predictions for binary and spiral mergers, which form the basis of producing waveforms, which form the basis of inferring merger properties of the binaries, and so on and so forth. In this game, there are different approaches. One is the so-called post-Newtonian approximation, which is an approximation in small coupling G and of order because the binary is a virialized system of order to small velocity of the binary constituents. And so those are the small parameters in this perturbation theory. Another important approach is a so-called self-force approach, where you model the binary system as a perturbation about a Schwarzschild spacetime. So you take one of the masses heavy, one light, in the limit that the light mass has no effect on the heavy mass, then you have basically a geodesic in Schwarzschild background. But you can then correct for that systematically in ratios of the masses. One of the more robust and perhaps main methods is, of course, numerical relativity. Having said that, though, it is not complete in the sense that there are very important regions of parameter space where numerical relativity is not viable. And so these two analytic approaches are very important. So currently, when we make waveforms, it's actually a hybrid of analytic approaches and numerical relativity. Numerical relativity can be expensive and in some regions just not viable, okay? So current knowledge for post-Newtonian is at fourth order. So that's 4 corrections on top of Newton's law. And this has been known since 2014. Currently, 5PN is pretty close. I think we're down to 2 parameters to determine 5PN. But for third generation gravitational wave observatories, we want something like 6PN. For self-force, we've known one self-force since the 1990s. In 2018, 2019, there's a few breakthrough papers on figuring out second order self-force, but it's still pretty early. Nonetheless, this is the goal for LISA. So for LISA, we want something like second order self-force. Okay, so the picture is that we have this very compelling gravitational wave science program with a network of detectors coming up and third generation detectors coming up. and there's going to be a wealth of data, something like 10 to the 6 mergers could be detected. And from that, we can learn so much cosmology, astrophysics, and particle physics. But on the other hand, this means that we need to invigorate our methods for theoretical predictions. Okay, and so the path that we've been approaching is, of course, to take a hard problem and turn it into an easier problem. If you're lucky, sometimes this is a very viable path, a useful path. And how do we do that? Well, for binary in spirals, you really want two black holes in spiraling. So it's a bound state of black holes. But an easier problem is actually scattering black holes. So you have black holes, far away from each other at infinity. They come in, they scatter, and then they go off at infinity again. Why is this a good idea? Well, first, because when you consider this process on the right, it's relativistic. So relativity, of course, is a good symmetry to have, makes calculations easier, so on and so forth. Second is because scattering, we have a lot of tools from theoretical high energy physics to deal with scattering that we've used, for example, to analyze processes at the LHC. So these include, for example, on-shell methods, advanced multi-loop integration that has been applied for QCD, and of course, effective field theory. So just to say that scattering is the natural habitat of quantum field theorists, and as quantum field theorists, that's what we see. Those are the tools that we want to use. And most importantly, it's because scattering is not a totally different problem. You could say, well, you could do scattering, but I don't care, because LIGO is not going to see scattering black holes. They're going to see bound black holes in spiraling. And that's true, and this is why it's crucial that actually for a lot of processes, there is a factorization between the initial and final states, that is whether you care about scattering or bound states, and the underlying dynamics. In other words, you can sniff out a lot of information about bound states just from studying scattering states, because there is a factorization anyway. So in other words, like, you could consider scattering states, but still determine the dynamics underlying the same two processes, okay? So that's the basic idea. And before getting to the details of how the computation goes, let me show you whether it works or not. So here is a plane of, here's a map of perturbation theory. So in this description of binary in spirals, we want to be more precise by computing corrections of order G. So G is G Newton, and also velocity corrections, okay? So this point right here, g times v to the zero, is Newton's law. And as I said, the post-Newtonian correction works by considering g of order v squared as the small parameter. So here, this would be 0 pn. This diagonal right here would be 1 pn. This diagonal would be 2 pn. 3 pn and 4 pn. So this triangle right here represents the pn order that we know completely currently. But as I said, if we are interested in doing science with a cosmic explorer or Einstein telescope, then we need predictions up to 6 pn. And if you notice, of order g is of course a tree level calculation. This is 1 loop, 2 loop, 3 loop, 4 loop, 5 loop, 6 loop. So it gets to crazy loop orders. And at this point you may ask, how the heck are you gonna compute 6 loop corrections and so on. So we'll discuss that in a bit. But let me just show you what we've done so far. So this is how post-Newtonian corrections work. They compute diagonals in this plane. If you compute using quantum field theory tools where you're not assuming small velocity because we're computing scattering states, we just compute in the small g correction, then you would go along these rows, okay? So in this first paper, we just considered the very basic framework of how exactly do we compute corrections to binary in spirals from scattering amplitudes, computing tree level and one loop, okay? And then, of course, we naturally extended that to two loop. So this is of order g cubed and all orders in v. So as you can see, we are now supplying input into part of what LIGO or whatever gravitational wave observatory needs to know. And very recently, we determined the three loop result. Okay, so this is g to the fourth all orders and velocity. So the quantum field theory results work order by order in g, all orders and velocity. And in the overlap region here between this dark green triangle and the red rectangle, we have complete agreement with the Pochettonian results. They're in different gauges, but we can do a canonical transformation to check that they're the same, or we can also just compute physical observables to make sure that the gauge dependence drop, but they completely overlap. And now, so for example, here, we've determined a huge part of, an infinitude of corrections, but also importantly, a part of what they actually need to know. Okay. Any questions so far?
Yeah. Can I jump in with a question?
Yeah.
This is Cliff. I remember talking to Walter Goldberger about this, and he gave me the impression that he thought that the non PPN thing was not a controlled approximation, which is that seems kind of funny. And so probably what that comes down to is what goes, you know, if the G's come with M over R, so the vertical thing was powers of GM over R, then you can kind of see that the diagonals are counting the same thing. But is it known systematically at any order, like G to the six, for example, that the G's always come together with specifically M over R, or are there other combinations that can arise?
No, it should come with that.
So I mean, for example,
an R Schwarzschild over R. So so here, this is a map of corrections of Newton's law. So first of all, I said that this is a map of perturbation theory in G and V. It's corrections to Newton's law, which means that this is only corrections to the potential. There are radiative corrections, which I'm not talking about today, but all of this is potential. And the potential can be written as an expansion in R Schwarzschild over R.
But that's actually the maybe it's radiative corrections that was the worry. So that at some point, because I know that if you're looking at like for instance the old Donahue calculation, you know, there's the relativistic corrections are going in powers of GM over R, whereas the quantum corrections are going in powers of, you know, G over R squared or something like that. And
I'll touch upon this a little bit later. Specifically, what is a quantum correction, a classical correction? Yeah.
But if I kind of take a specific, I guess the question in the end of the day conceptually would be, if I take some specific point in that grid, you know, it sounds like there's a third direction that would count things like G over R squared. Has the power counting been done for all of those things? So you know that for any one of the points in that three-dimensional grid, I know exactly what I have to calculate.
Yeah. So to get onto this grid, I've already thrown out quantum corrections.
Yeah, but I'm asking you to put them back in. And so if I asked for something which is V to the 12th and G to the 7th, is there something which is G cubed V to the 4th, but some power of quantum corrections that competes with it, I guess is what I'm asking.
Oh, no. Quantum corrections are very small.
Well, they're small by G powers of G over R. And so the question is, you know, have people power counted? I can believe that numerically in practice, they're not going to be important, but have people power counted all the dimensionless things that are being expanded in?
I'm not sure I understand your question correctly, but the first step that we do is to take the scattering amplitude and take the classical limit of it. So we power count such that all quantum corrections are removed. And then that classical amplitude has a particular scaling in G and a particular scaling in R.
Right.
And that's what gives this G over R. And then these velocity corrections are just P over M.
Right, and I guess my question, and I accept that that's a great thing to do, but in EFT, you would the way you would phrase that is you'd say that, you know, that in principle you're expanding in everything, and then you're focusing on the dominant part of one of the expansions. Mm-hmm. But normally, a useful thing to have is kind of a power counting statement that if I want to know the answer to order, you know, x powers of v, y powers of gm over r, and z powers of g over r squared, let's say, I know exactly which class of graphs I need to evaluate.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's has that been done? Is that?
Oh yeah, that's what we do.
But including the G over R squared terms, like the quantum corrections?
Oh no, we don't. We throw out all quantum corrections.
Okay, thanks.
So yeah, we're completely focusing on the classical corrections. Maybe you can ask this question again a few slides later. I'll talk about classical versus quantum corrections. But yeah, thanks for the question. Okay. Right. So these are the kinds. And one interesting, very interesting thing for us is the theorists are at LIGO are actually pretty interested. So about a week after our paper, they came out with a paper taking our functions, which are encoded in a Hamiltonian that they can study binary n-spirals with. So for example, here, you can see a plot of orbits to merger. So the number of orbits before the merger happens and binding energy, okay? And here's a plot of the tree level result in purple, one loop result in blue, two loop result in red. So as you can see, it gets closer and closer to numerical relativity, which here we're taking as truth, okay? But not yet quite as good as this phenomenological model called EOB, which is what actually is being used to develop waveforms. But this EOB thing is sort of a catch-all model where you can input into it as much information, as much truth as you have to make the model more and more robust. And in fact, they consider inputting these outputs from quantum field theory into EOB, and you can see that it actually does remarkably well. Okay, so this is one reason that they're interested, is because these outputs from EOB, from QFT, that have information to all orders of velocity might inform these phenomenological models and improve them. Very recently, there was a conference at GGI that actually, where actually they presented new plots. It's not yet published, but they are preparing this paper. And they took now our three loop results and did the same thing. So essentially you have tree level, one loop, two loop, and orange is three loop. And it gets very close to numerical relativity at the point where also EOB is getting close. So it looks pretty comparable to their phenomenological model. And in fact, here, if you again consider plugging in to the phenomenological model, then it improves even more. Okay, so this is very good for us that the output of our calculations are actually of interest to people who are very close to the experiment. Aside from that, these results have also led to a lot of interesting exchanges between the general relativity community and the high energy theory community. Let me just highlight a few. For example, the first check of our result actually was done by relativists here in a paper by Bini, Damur, and Geralico, and they actually ended up developing an entirely new method from that check. Which has been very, very powerful in getting new kinds of corrections. Here, let me highlight another one. There's been lots of checks, but I'm just picking a few here for time's sake. Here, I'd like to highlight this check, which is a partial check of our three loop result. They completely agree, but one thing interesting about this is that it's composed of three people who do QCD and a relativist. And then finally, let me just comment that Tiwa Damur has been really interested in the high energy behavior of our results. It had initially caused him some confusion, but eventually he had come to agreement with it. Okay.
Mikhail, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So in your methods, can you incorporate in a simple way the possibility that, or let me state it a different way. Depending on the perturbation, you can capture more easily or not the fact that the black hole space energy you're forming upon merger will have a significant rotation spin. So some methods don't do that. They go first with a non-spinning black hole and correct over it. So for instance, in the case of an equal mass merger, the spin, the results of non-spinning black holes colliding, it's pretty substantial. It's 0.7 or thereabouts. Would you have a natural way of incorporating that?
So are you asking about black hole spin?
Yes.
Yeah. So indeed. So unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about spin. But you can incorporate spin by instead of considering scalars, you consider scattering states with quantum spin. But in fact, if you take the large spin limit, you can derive classical results in spin. So for example, spin orbit coupling, spin coupling, spin cube coupling, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so what I'm after is if you, so as a result of the merger, your black hole spacetime is going to be increasingly better described by a curved black hole. Again, just this is equal mass non-spinning black holes coming together. The final product is a curved black hole that has a spin of close to 0.7.
I see.
Would this be a natural thing you can incorporate somehow? I mean, I think one of the significant shortcomings of the standard ways people are doing going about trying to use perturbations is missing that point.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I have not thought about that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, maybe we can chat more after.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, so yeah, let me just finally say that, of course, the reason they're interested is, as I said, even though there are now very sophisticated numerical relativity results that capture the whole waveform, currently the state of the art is really just producing waveforms using a hybrid input. So for the in-spiral phase, analytic results are being used, and closer to the merger, late in-spiral, closer to the merger and the ring down, numerical relativity results are being used. So these two things are being merged, and our hope is that quantum field theory results can really drive innovations for analytic results in the early in-spiral phase, okay? But as we've discussed at this point,
Could I interrupt with a question?
Yes.
Yeah, so just wondering, so when you were showing us the expansion and powers of G and powers of V, that was just for the potential, right?
Correct, that was for the
potential. Yeah. So I was just wondering what part of that parameter space have you covered? Like, do you have the full waveform for
in this method? Yeah, so to produce waveforms, you probably know this, to produce waveforms, you need the conservative piece, the potential, and also the flux. We have so far focused on potential. It was more natural from our jumping point, but right now we are going into flux. There are new results for the flux, but there are still specialized to scattering states. So part of what needs to be done is to translate that to bound states or a way in order to compute flux for bound states from scattering dynamics. But yes, the goal is to help as much as possible in all these respects, both conservative and dissipative. And only very recently, like within the year, have we started to compute things, including dissipation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so but I guess the short answer was that right now there are no systematic results for the waveforms at any term that includes all powers of V.
So right now our mindset is sort of we want to plug into the pipeline that they're currently using. And as we understand it, the pipeline takes in the conservative Hamiltonian, which is what we're computing, and also the flux. And so if we can compute both of these things, then we can plug into the pipeline. So we have not been in the mindset of starting directly from QFT and getting the waveform out. But this is an interesting question, and people are more and more thinking about this, actually. But just to begin, the initial works, and which is the basis of most of my talk, we were thinking of, you know, what quantities are directly relevant to the pipeline, and let's compute that versus skipping their pipeline altogether and getting waveforms straight out. There are computations of, you know, waveforms from scattering states that at this point have been reproduced. And so, yeah, maybe potentially in the future, we could consider directly computing waveforms instead of having the problem into a conservative part and a dissipative part and handing it to our LIGO friends. You could conceive of maybe waveforms directly from quantum field theory. And I think this is an interesting question. People have been thinking about this.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, but so right now just we are producing the quantities that we know go into their pipeline, namely a Hamiltonian for conservative dynamics and the flux. Okay, so at this point you might have questions about exactly what it means to have a scalable pipeline using quantum field theory. In particular, if I just wrote down the Einstein-Hilbert action coupling massive scalars and worked out the Feynman rules for that, and then said that we will compute these loops, and then said that, oh, we want to help with precision gravitational wave science, so we better get up to 6 loops, then this whole idea just dies immediately because it's not scalable. And this is actually something that we've really worked towards, trying to build something scalable, not just reproducing results at lower orders. And the good thing is we have many of the tools of QFT at our disposal. So in particular, we can start with gauge theory amplitudes, square that using the double copy to get gravitational amplitudes, sew these tree level amplitudes together into loops using generalized unitarity, compute these loops using advanced integration methods and effective field theory methods to get out the classical amplitude. And once we have the classical amplitude, there's a simple map using effective field theory to get out a Hamiltonian. And once you have a Hamiltonian, it didn't matter if it came from a scattering state, you can also describe bound states. So as I said, this pipeline right here is currently focused on the conservative dynamics. There's tweaks of this to incorporate the dissipative dynamics and so on, but this is the general idea, okay? And most importantly, perhaps, is that the classical limit is taken at the very earliest stages. So at step one, at any step where you can take the classical limit, we take the classical limit. And the reason is because if we kept quantum corrections, then we probably won't be able to do better than 2 or 3 loop because quantum loops are hard, okay? Okay, so like I said, if we just took the Einstein-Hilbert action and work with Feynman rules, that might not scale because Feynman rules for gravity are messy, but we can use on-shell methods. So we can start with gauge theory amplitudes, square them, and get gravitational amplitudes using the double copy, and then we can sew those together to get loops. And the second problem was that integration of quantum loops won't scale, but it turns out that we are actually interested in a very simple region of these loop amplitudes. So Cliff, this is where I'm going to try to say more to hopefully address your question, but please let me know if the question isn't addressed. So we are thinking about two black holes that are far apart. The momentum transfer is the Fourier space conjugate to 1 and r, or the distance. So we want this momentum transfer to be small. So we are really considering loops where the momentum transfer or all of the gravitational exchangers are soft, okay? But if you're going to take that, for example, in QED, that doesn't get you classical effects. In fact, as Anish would say, classical effects are smaller than quantum in real life, because in his real life is QED, where, for example, if you just took the small Q over M limit, that would kill these quantum corrections. But the classical corrections are also suppressed by Q over M, and in QED, they're suppressed by Q squared over Q Planck squared, where typically, let's say this is an electron, that's also a small number. So for QED, actually, quantum effects dominate. The picture is quite different for astrophysical black holes that are in spiraling, because now this factor of charge squared over charge of Planck charge squared is now 10 to the 38. So the quantum corrections are down by Q over M. The classical corrections also have a factor of Q over M, but they're enhanced by a factor of astrophysical mass squared over Planck mass squared. So of course, 1 in Planck mass squared is G, okay? So this is why this limit isolates the classical pieces for GR, not for QED, unless you have large charges, okay? Cliff, does that help? So this is the sort of power counting.
It kind of does, but it also doesn't, in the sense that so the argument you're giving there is the argument that you would normally give in even not for this problem, just in general for gravity, as to why quantum effects are small. But the point of power counting is not so much that a specific quantum effect in gravity will be important. It's just that it's the systematic identification of all the things that you're expanding in case you missed one. and so my real question is this is a kind of a momentum, what you're describing it as a momentum space thing. And I completely get that the classical level, you're probably capturing everything. But I have this, there's a lot of scales in the problem once these things start to come together. And so one would worry, could there have been another scale on dimensional grounds? Are there other dimensionless things I could be expanding in? And I was just wondering how systematically that was done, mostly because when I ask other people about this kind of post-Minkowski as opposed to the post-Newtonian thing, one of the things that they tell me is that it's under less control, and I don't really understand why. And I'm wondering if that would be why.
I'm not sure why. I mean, post-Minkowskian is in fact what's closer to what we do in QFT. It's just a small G expansion.
Yeah, but G is cut dimension. So you're always comparing G to something. And the question is what the something is, right?
Yeah. So as I said, it's R Schwarzschild over R.
Well, that's one of the combinations. And the question is, are there other ones? And I guess, so that's where the power counting analysis would help, because it would tell you that there are no other ones, right?
Yeah, there are no other ones. Q is R. So in momentum space, you have Q, the incoming momenta are of order M. So it's Q and M.
So what I'm understanding, and tell me if this is wrong, just I'm playing back to you what I think you're saying, is that within this classical regime, you're saying that the power counting has been done, but outside the classical regime, it's probably not important, but it has not been done. Is that right?
You could systematically, take the Q over M corrections that we've been throwing out, and that's what you would mean by outside the classical regime. So the amplitude has these two factors, and we're throwing out anything suppressed by this, but keeping this, because for gravity, we're considering astrophysical black holes, which have large charge. So yeah, you can systematically keep corrections like this if you want. So you take your amplitude, you take the soft limit of it, expanding Q over M systematically, and we just truncate at the classical order. If you want the next order, and you compute the next order. For example, we can systematically reproduce Donahue's first quantum correction by just keeping the next order in Q. And if you want the next one, then we keep the next one. There's no, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm not sure. Actually, it would be maybe helpful for me to understand what you meant by maybe the PM is not as well controlled as the PN. That's maybe one reason why I'm not answering your question, but maybe we can talk about this later.
Yeah, I'm just actually, I saw a similar talk that Walter Goldberger gave, and I asked him the question as to about this post-Minkowskian, and that was his response to me, was that it was the less, it wasn't as a systematic an expansion as the post-Newtonian one. And I didn't pin him down as to the details. And so since it's not coming from me, I can't give you more than that.
I mean, certainly the post-Newtonian is much more systematic in the sense that, it is designed to capture the very many scales of a bound state. So you have, the orbital radius, orbital frequency, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So it's just two different problems. It's like doing QED for scattering electrons versus doing QED for positronium.
Right, thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry, so I have a very naive question. So what is Q here for the GR case?
Q is the momentum transfer. Small Q is the momentum transfer.
Oh, okay.
Here these capital Qs are charges.
Okay, so you have some kind of, so it's like H bar times Q as energy.
Yeah, so if you want, the other way to do it is to put all the H bars in and then power count in H bar, but that can be confusing. I like to use units in H bar equals one. So all you have to realize is that it's small momentum transfers because the black holes are far apart and they can't really exchange momentum of order their masses. Otherwise they would annihilate each other or something like that. They would exchange basically their whole energy or momentum.
Okay.
Okay, so this is then what lands us on a classical limit. It's a very simple soft expansion. And it turns out, as I said, the only hope to really do precision gravitational wave science with this, if we need to compute something like a five loop or six loop calculation, is that the classical limit is simple. And indeed, so far, it has been really, really simplifying. In fact, you know, you would throw out a lot of diagrams. Like, for example, this one, the number of black holes are not conserved. So this is not a classical process. Here in DIMREG, these are both scaleless integrals because the momentum transfer here is not of this graviton is not fixed by Q. So it actually probes quantum corrections. And similarly for this. In fact, it's quite simple that you can write down the Einstein-Hilbert action, including the gauge fixing term, and write the most general field basis that you can, so the ugliest, in other words. And on top of that, add higher dimensional operators. So here C are vial tensors coupling to scalar squared. So these would represent tidal effects. So instead of just point particle black holes, scalars, now they have finite size effects. So here is another aspect where EFT comes into play. You have power corrections, writing down operators with vial. Okay? And you can do this calculation, this two-loop calculation, completely using Feynman rules. Not that on-shell methods are not useful. This just means that on-shell methods will be even more powerful. So if a two-loop calculation, and I'm sure a three-loop calculation that we did is also doable by Feynman rules, that means that with on-shell methods, we can even go further. So this is all to say that we've been thinking really hard about whether this method scales or not, because we are, again, thinking of doing precision on gravitational wave science, not just reproducing low-order results.
Can I ask you a simple question? You're at this stage, you're not accounting for the spin of the black holes, right? They're just scalar, it's a scalar field.
Correct.
And what is, in this language, the how would you input the spin of the black holes?
Yeah, so for example, if you wanted your scatters to have spin, then instead of a scalar, you would use a fermion or a general spin n object.
Oh, okay, because I mean, just at the very superficial level, I was surprised by the fact that it would be a quantized spin, whereas it would have a continuous spin from 0 to 1 in for the black holes.
Yeah. So when we write down this field theory, it's quantized spin. But then when you compute the amplitudes, you'll see that, for example, the spin orbit coupling is universal to any of these quantized spins. So you can take the large spin limit, and that would be the result.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like in heavy quark theory, where a lot of the spin operators don't actually depend on the spin. They depend on the spin on trivial factors, but there's a universality in the sense that some operators are universal to any spin heavy quarks, or spin 13 and halves and below will be the same for a certain operator and so on. It's the same universality.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So for example, if you write down a heavy quark for a spin half and compare that to a scalar, there's a subset of operators that will be the same, and so on and so forth. As you go higher spin, there's universality for some of the lower spin operators. So for example, if I'm only interested in spin orbit, then I can put in a fermion here and I will get the right spin orbit result. If I'm interested in spin, then I need to scatter, for example, 2 spin-1/2 particles. But that would be the same result as if I scattered 2 spin-1 particles. I should get the same. Okay. I don't want to get into too much of the details, but let me just mention a few. As I said, we get the classical contributions when we scale the gravitons that are exchanged small, so they're of order Q. So this is their energy and this is 3 momentum and they're both of order Q. Cliff, this might be a point that this might connect to your question. This soft region actually still contains some quantum pieces. And what we actually do is follow NRGR, which is the framework developed by Walter and Ira, and split this soft into potential and radiation. And here we can isolate classical pieces even further. So in other words, if we only computed purely in soft apparently still contains some quantum pieces, but we can further remove those by specializing in potential and radiation. So perhaps this is one place where our method for doing PM still carries a little bit of quantum up to the point where we connect to it. The methods of NRGR by expanding potential and radiation. So this is a very powerful method and helps us with the scalability. In particular, it halves the problem into, you know, conservative pieces versus dissipative pieces, roughly, and makes the problem more modular. So we can use different tools for these different pieces. The price to pay, of course, is that we're splitting, we're assigning different power counting to energy components and momentum components, which breaks relativity. So this is inherently non-relativistic. And what we have to do then is to design a different integration method that, despite this inherent non-relativistic nature, still allows us to capture the full PM relativistic result. And there are some interesting tools such as integration over energy residues. I won't go into that, but this process of integrating over energy residues essentially determines boundary conditions. And then the velocity corrections are then solved for using differential equations. Okay, so that's how we use the power of EFT developed in energy R, but at the same time capture all orders in velocity correction. Okay.
Can I just ask a follow-up question there? But I see Luis actually has his hand up, and I don't know if he's waiting for a question or if he's...
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe he just forgot to take his hand down.
Exactly. The latter.
Okay. Yeah. So just a related question is, you know, in the analog of all this engaged theories, there's a lot of sophisticated things that are done to deal with logarithms, such as the collinear divergences and the whole, you know, SCET direction that you can take these effective theories. Is there an analog of that, those kind of phenomena in gravity? Do you have that kind of unusual large logarithms coming from initial state radiation or and radiation from external legs, the kind of stuff that would have been sketchy in QCD? Is there a gravity?
Yeah, there should be.
And does it arrive as kind of at any of the orders that are of practical interest to you guys, or is it?
There's one hint of it, which I'll actually mention.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay. So now let me just show you some of the amplitudes. I've talked about how to build the integrand using on-shell methods, how I gave you a little bit of a taste of how we take the classical limit and then the tools that we use to integrate them, namely advanced multi-loop methods and also effective field theory. And so here are some of the results. So very basic tree-level result, you see the order G. Okay, so if you take the non-relativistic limit of this, you get Newton's law. Here's the order G. And here is the Q power. So you take this the small Q limit at the very beginning before integration, of course, and this is the Q power that remains. If you take the Fourier transform of this, this will give you a power of 1 on R. Okay, so this whole thing gives you Newton's law times velocity correction. Sigma here is basically related to Mandelstam S, or is P1 dot, P1 and P2 are the two incoming momenta, and sigma is P1 dot P2 normalized by the masses M1, M2, okay? So that's tree level. At one loop, you get an extra power of G, of course, and then the power of Q is lower, it's Q to the minus 1, whose Fourier transform now is 1 on R. So this is now the 1 on R potential correction, the 1 on R correction to the 1 on R, to Newton's law. Okay, and here is again the velocity correction. So here at tree level and one loop, you see the velocity corrections are quite simple. They're just polynomials in Mandelstam S. Okay. At two loop, things become more interesting. Again, you get a power of G extra because it's a loop higher. The Q dependence now is a log. And this log Q, if you Fourier transform, is just 1 on R cubed. So it just happens that the 1 on R cubed is conjugate to log Q squared. You get now rational factors of the Mandelstam S, or the sigma parameter, and also an R cosh, which you can, of course, write as a logarithm. Okay, so things start to become complicated. And the reason is that tree level and one loop are actually completely encoded in the Schwarzschild solution, as I'll mention more later on, whereas at two loop order you become sensitive to one order self force. And you can see that here. This new parameter is the symmetric mass ratio. So nu goes as m1, m2 over capital M squared. Capital M squared is a total mass, m1 plus m2. And you can see here when you send nu to zero here, nothing remains. The whole thing is just encoded in the probe limit. Whereas here, if you send nu to zero, there's of course this nu squared that's leading, but this term dies out first. This term and this term both die out first. And what remains is what's encoded in the probe limit. These nu of order, are then one self force corrections. Okay. Let me just quickly flash a three loop. A three loop, you again have what's encoded in the probe limit, an order nu correction. So again, this is encoded completely in one self force. You have a 1 over epsilon divergence because we are considering only the potential region. And at this order, the overlap between potential and radiation becomes important. And that's what's causing this 1 over epsilon divergence. It's an artifact of us splitting these momentum regions of gravitons being exchanged. And you have a finite piece. And these pieces are given by simple rational terms for the probe limit. More complicated functions of logarithms for the tail term that has the 1 over epsilon divergence, and even more complicated polylogarithms of weight 2, including elliptic functions right here for the finite piece, okay? Where these H's here are not numbers, but also rational functions of sigma. So it's starting to become complicated at three loop order, okay? There's some interesting bits here, which I won't go into, but for example, let me mention that there's certain combinations of Ricci square that appear, or electric Weyl square rather, that appear in these factors. Okay, but those are the amplitudes. So after integration, that's what you get. And these are now what we call classical amplitudes because they have only the leading order scaling in Q. And when you Fourier transform, you get the right scaling in R for them to be the classical corrections.
So can I ask a question here?
Yes.
So you're saying this 3 and 4 loop amplitudes only depends on the first order self force. Do you have a general argument?
Yes.
For high loops?
Yeah, I'll show you the general argument.
But if you have this argument, like at least for 3 and 4 loop result, because we know the first order self force, in principle, we can just use that self force also to compute that.
Correct.
Order yeah. 3 and 4 loop
result. Yeah. So by the way, sorry, these are order 2 and 3 results, two loop and three loop results, not 4 loop. But yes, okay. There is a clear connection between the nth loop correction and the mth self force correction, which I will get into later. So I owe you two things at this point. I owe you this for self force correction and Cliff's question about SCET relations, but relations to ideas in SCET. Okay, so I'll get into that. So at this point we have the amplitude. How do we get to a Hamiltonian? Now we're getting to an even simpler calculation where we just now write down a theory of two scalars interacting via potential. So I'm not writing out a kinetic term here, but this is how they interact. And this is the most general classical potential that you can write down. So as I told you, it's powers of G over R. If you put in the M's here, the M's are lumped into C, but you can put in the M's here to write this as R Schwarzschild over R. So this is not dimensionless right now, but you can take the M's here and they always come in that combination. And just a function of P squared or velocity corrections. So that's the most general thing. And what you now do is you take this theory, you compute with it, and you compare it to your gravity calculation. And that will determine the C's because you're demanding an equal sign. So you do this at tree level, you determine C1. So this is just a matching calculation. You do this at one loop. So you compute in this theory up to one loop. So you compute this one loop bubble and that determines C2. And you do that to determine C3 and so forth. Interestingly, if you do this in general, what you'll find is that the amplitude actually is nicely written in terms of, in classical mechanics, what's known as the radial action, okay? So this is one type of relation between classical amplitudes and quantities in classical dynamics that we found. There's another one where the classical amplitude is actually related to the local momentum in a classical scattering system. But here maybe is one that might be recognizable to people who have recently studied classical mechanics. This is just the radial action that you take derivatives of, and it'll give you, for example, observables. So doing this matching calculation in general actually shows these interesting relations between classical limits of scattering amplitudes and quantities in classical dynamics. But this is, of course, sort of a formal packaging of what we're doing, but essentially we're doing a matching calculation, and this allows us to determine the coefficient C. And there are some aspects of this that are really crucial for scalability. For example, there are actually pieces of this that are just exponentiated. So take this box here, there's a contribution where you're on the cut of these two propagators, and that's just going to be the tree level squared. So it's important that that piece will be subtracted also in the AFT so that you're not double counting. So there are these systematic aspects of the matching that first help with scalability, but also make sure that the things are all lined up. Okay, so once you have those coefficients C, then you can now construct your Hamiltonian. You have kinetic terms, you have the potential, and then you just write out your C's. So these are the C's that we get up to three loop order. So here is tree level C, one loop C, two loop C, and the three loop C written in terms of the amplitudes that I showed you earlier, okay? Okay, so aside from the practical output of having a Hamiltonian that can hopefully help with persistent gravitational wave science, as theorists, we're also interested in studying theoretical structures that we meet when we're doing these calculations. So first and foremost, of course, our results are all Lorentz invariant. And interestingly, the fact that they're on shell actually leads to very, very simple expressions compared to what's in the GR literature in other gauges, for example. So that's one small comment. A second comment is that because we're doing scattering, this allows us to consider other aspects that are not accessible from a PN calculation. So from a PN calculation, you would never think of taking the high energy behavior just because you are expanding in small velocity. But for our calculation, we can do that. And interestingly, if you do that, you get these logs, double logs, which are in fact reminiscent of double logs that you would get in the Reggie limit. So this is where SET might, this is where one connection to SET appears, where you could actually consider two black holes, one in the N direction, one in the N bar direction, exchanging gravitons, and take the large S limit of that, okay? So you would, for example, use the formalism for globular modes, okay, that Ira and Ian developed, and you would try to resum the large logs. And they are, of course, double logs in that case, but because we're only interested in the classical limit, this double log appears for us as this double log, okay? And not surprisingly, this has ties to radiation, okay? As has been worked out in these papers. Finally, another theoretical structure that we've encountered is this exponentiation, which is expressed as in this equation that I've shown you. But roughly what it means is that part of the amplitudes that we're computing at higher order are actually just exponentiated pieces of the lower order amplitudes. And those have to be subtracted systematically. But because also we know they're exponentiated pieces, we can just identify them and not compute them at all. So it helps us with higher order calculations to know that they're pieces that we don't actually need because they're just redundant with lower order pieces.
Is this a special case of the old Weinberg infrared resummation, or is this a different thing?
A limit of this will be related to that, the Iconal case.
So this is more general than that.
Yeah, it's not Iconal. We consider, non-iconal exchanges, like triangles, boxes with things in the middle, and so on. So the graphs are not completely just iconal ladders.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't, I'm not sure. The way I think about the Weinberg thing is that he's basically doing Bloch Nordzig for gravity, right? He's just, he's looking at soft emission.
This one?
I'm talking about the exponentiation at the bottom there. The there's this, you know, there's general argument that if you radiate massless lines from or particles from external lines of some hard process, things exponentiate. And in the 60s, Weinberg kind of worked out what that looked like for gravity. And I'm wondering what the relationship is to that of that between that and this that you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood. I meant that this is related to iconal exponentiation of exchange ladders. Is that what you mean? But yeah, not the soft theory might be more closely related to this radiation off of the initial and final states.
Yeah, they're probably related in the sense that you know there's a connection between the soft emission and the infrared limit of the hard process, because that's part of the cancellation that happens. And so, mm-hmm. but that the language of Eichenholz, I'm not sure how to translate it into that. So
the words that you just said is exactly closely related to this. The fact that we're finding a logarithm is we're finding a logarithm that needs to be canceled by radiation emission.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, and then the last piece of theoretical structure goes back to the question about self-force. If you compute these amplitudes in a classical limit, one thing that becomes obvious is that there's a very simple dependence on the two masses. So at tree level, it's just an order g, and then m1 squared, m2 squared, symmetric between m1 and m2, of course. At one loop, it's g squared, m1 cubed, m2 squared, plus the symmetric piece, and so on and so forth, okay? So this is the structure just based on dimensional analysis and relativity. And so you can see that these leading terms, suppose we were to take the large m1 limit, then M1 would be just a Schwarzschild black hole. And this is actually all zero SF corrections. In fact, you can resum this. So you take all these graphs here that are zero SF, resum it, and this is the resulting amplitude expressed in terms of metric components of Schwarzschild and isotropic coordinates. Okay, so it's interesting that resummation in this case of graphs is not through some renormalization group, but rather the geodesic equation, okay? One power of mass down would, of course, be one self-force. And so, as noted earlier, one self-force starts at two loop and three loop, and so on. But the statement is that one self-force will completely determine two loop and three loop. So the comment earlier was right, that if you knew one self-force, you could completely determine two loop and three loop. And this, in fact, has been the basis of the method of Bini and Damour and Gerlache for determining higher order corrections. Basically, they take self-force results and from that bootstrap PN and PM, PN corrections, okay? And of course, you can keep on going and the four loop and five loop results would be completely determined by second order self-force. So this is actually a new direction that, well, the past year or so, I've been hearing more talks about self-force people trying to compute self-force corrections for hyperbolic orbits, in other words, scattering, in order to make contact with our results from QFT. So this is another interesting direction. Okay, so let me just summarize this point. So gravitational wave science has opened up a new direction in theoretical high energy physics, leveraging the tools of quantum field theory to do precision gravitational wave science, for example. And it turns out, in my opinion, that the classical binary dynamics really has the hallmarks of a great problem in theoretical high energy physics. Namely that one, we get to do these fun calculations in QFT. Two, that we get to explore new theoretical landscapes, namely the connections between classical limits of scattering amplitudes and classical dynamics. And finally, most importantly, perhaps, is that it has a real connection to a very important experimental frontier, namely gravitational waves. And finally, the talk today was, of course, limited. I couldn't talk about a lot of things. This program is new, and there's a lot of rapid development. I did not talk about spin. I only briefly described how we incorporate tidal effects. There's also very new work regarding radiation and so on and so forth. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Thank you. Very nice talk. Are there more questions?
Well, let me jump in if no one else is. So it sounds like you've got one of these programs where there's an industry that you could head off, you could head off in, and that there's a million things to do and lots of observational reasons to do them. So it's kind of a very good place to be. Of these various lists of things, can you hear me?
Sorry, you broke up. No, the last thing I heard was a million things to do.
Yeah, it sounds like you have lots of things to do, lots of potential applications and lots of ideas as to how to apply this. What's the highest priority of this list of on your to-do list that you have to do next?
I think the highest priority in terms of the program would be to do something that really would get into the pipeline for data analysis, right? On its own, it's a very interesting program. There's lots to explore and compute. But if it were to be taken seriously as a real method that could help with gravitational wave science, then the first goal would be to compute something that would be useful, I think. And so that's sort of that's a very broad answer. But that's sort of one of the main goals, is to compute something that's useful, so that we can say that this is not just us doing things in a different way. It actually is getting new results. And by the way, the two loop and the three loop are already new. And people are now considering putting them in, but we're not at the stage yet that that's happening. So for that to happen, we need higher order corrections to the potential, but also, as I've told you, within the past year, now starting to think about radiative effects. So the potential is just half the problem. The other half of the problem is understanding radiation. So there's a lot there. So parts of the radiation has contributions to conservative dynamics. There's this so-called tail effect, for example, where your binary emits a radiation, but it interacts with the potential of the binary. And so it's actually a conservative effect. Those are the priority. Depending on who you talk to, some people are more interested in black holes with spin. So they would say, the priority would be to do this for spinning black holes.
Actually, since you mentioned spin, I don't know if Luis is still there. He had asked earlier about, can you organize this in a way which would speak more directly to the final spin of the Kerr hole you get after the merger. But the way you're setting it up, it sounds like it's very much a perturbative story about the in spiral.
Yes.
And whereas the spin at the end of the day sounds like it's more of an expansion around the final black hole.
Yes.
I wonder, Luis, if you can you comment more about how that bridge would be made between the...
Sure, but I don't know how that bridge would be made. In the past, there's been a few works, not many, where that program has been attempted to at a very, very rudimentary level, where you say, well, I'm coming in with some budget, which are the two black holes that are coming together, but I'm gonna leave all the parameters free in some sense, and will be adjusted to what the final product is. And once you do that, a lot of things fall into place much more naturally. Because in some sense, if I'm bringing together things that are non-spinning and yet I'm forming a black hole spacetime that is significantly highly spinning, I mean, just to use a very graphical and stupid example, I can definitely describe a zebra by deforming a cow, but it's a lot easier if I use a horse.
But so what would be the parameters that they would leave free in that kind of in the things you're alluding to, the people who have found things simplifying?
Right, you say, well, let's say in the non-spinning black binary case, you leave, for instance, key quantities that come in this, or key instances that come in this approach is what the ISCO is, and the ISCO will be determined by the mass and spin of the final black hole, which come at the level where you try and set up some sort of balance law of conservation of to some degree of mass and angular momentum at that yet undetermined E score, which falls naturally once you impose that conservation. So it seems to me that perhaps a program to try is actually the upside down version of this, but I'm not sure where that can be done.
Wait, what do you mean by upside down version?
I flip the picture upside down. Whatever comes out in this is what you put in first. So what if I do the time reversal of this, if you want?
Oh.
I don't even know if that makes sense given these tools.
But somehow you're saying that the conservation of angular momentum, it sounds like there's some information that would have been, it's not being extracted efficiently somehow by focusing on the two black holes separately.
Well, at some point, all these things are trying to then match to something, and that something is missing some pieces. Right. So Michael pointed to this EOB. Most of the stuff that has been developed in the EOB relies on a Schwarzschild black hole that is deformed. But why deform a black hole when a Schwarzschild black hole when it could deform a curve?
Right. I see. Thank you.
Now that the spin is mentioned, I don't know. Maybe I can ask a question about spin as well. I don't know if it's strictly related. So there is this experiment, right? So if you scatter fields, spinning fields, and then you take the classical limit on whatever minimal coupling limit, and then you recover curves multiple moments somehow. So I never got the intuition why that is true and why we observe this curve moment by this scattering experiment. So I don't know if you can offer some intuition about that, or is it related at all? Or?
Yeah, actually, I'm not familiar with what you just said. You're saying that or maybe I can say it in a different way. Certainly, if we do scattering of spinning objects. Okay, so first of all, if we do scattering of non-spinning objects, as I've explained here, you see that there's really a piece where what you're describing is just a particle following a geodesic trajectory in a Schwarzschild background. And if you put spin on, let's say, M1, then it's a similar story, except you're following a geodesic in a curve background. Is that what you're asking?
No, I guess I was trying to say, I mean, here you're scattering two scalar fields, right? Like, yeah. But you could scatter fields with spins. And then I remember people would like even take the limit that the spin of the field goes to infinity or something. This, and then they observe that the result of the scattering gives you the curve multiple moments.
Yeah. So actually, I think I'm saying exactly that. So these are scattering of two scalars, and in this limit where M1 is large, you basically end up getting, for example, a probe particle in a Schwarzschild background, but if you do the same exercise, except for M1 having a spin, okay, so you give M1 a spin and make it much, much larger than M2, then this series of graphs that you sum will resum into an amplitude that knows about the Kerr metric. So in other words, that scattering process is just a probe particle following a geodesic in a Kerr background.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess my question is, in nature, we can have infinite many possibilities for object with a mass and spin. So the external metric for such object is generically non-curve. I don't know why suddenly this scattering experiment recovers the curve multiple moments or curve metric.
Yeah, I think in the classical limit, you're taking the limit of large spin. What is a black hole? What is a black hole with spin? It's curve. I mean,
it doesn't have to be a black hole, right? So in the scattering experiment, nowhere here is saying it's mapped to a black hole. It's just
So in the scattering experiment, there's just a particle with mass and spin. And if you're looking outside, a particle with mass and spin, the solution to Einstein's equation is a curved black hole. There's no charge, there's nothing. So what else could it be?
I mean, it doesn't have to be a black hole. The objects with mass and spin, the external
I'm not considering any higher order finite size corrections. So it's a point particle. By black hole, I just mean no tidal effects, no higher order operators composed of vial. So I'm just saying if you're scattering a point particle with spin, I assume when you say, why does it need to be a black hole? I assume you're saying as opposed to, let's say, a star with some finite size, like a neutron star.
Then
I would have to consider scattering with tidal effects and so on. But right now, I'm just considering a point particle with spin and a very, very tiny particle. And yes, that scattering process is equivalent to that tiny particle following a geodesic trajectory in a background spacetime of a spinning object with a mass.
If you're only comparing the, let's say, the dipole piece, I totally agree. But it seems the early results are also finding agreement on the higher order multiples, right? Like the quadruple or even higher multiples. So you are probing the higher multiples of the curved black hole. So in that sense, I was wondering why it has to be curved black hole. Another object with the same mass and spin as a curved black hole could have different quadruple moment or things like that.
By quadruple moment,
you could have a spin-induced quadruple moment. The curved black hole has a particular spin-induced quadruple moment.
I see.
Other stars can have other values.
If I understood correctly, those scattering processes, if you do them generally, they're free parameters. And only when you set those free parameters to particular values, I think one, do you recover a curve?
Yeah, so, that's something I don't understand. So people say it's minimal couple. I don't know what that means. But
exactly. So if you just consider the most general scattering process with a spinning object, they're actually free parameters because of the operators that you can write down. And so the answer will depend on these Wilson coefficients, C, 1 through whatever. And if you set them to minimal coupling, 1 or something, then you recover a curve. If you don't, then yeah, I guess you're describing something else, like a star or something.
I guess I don't understand why minimal couple just goes to the curve, but yeah, I guess what you're saying is true. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I can comment a bit of that.
Mm.
So the thing is that, you know, it's basically this universality that Solon was describing for a higher spinning particles. So that universality is basically recovered only for minimal coupling. And in that sense, you know, having universality basically means, you know, knowing all of the multiples of the curved black hole. You know, you can recover them from scattering amplitudes but you can compute, as Solon was saying, you can compute the scattering of a spin one particle or a spin two particles, and they will have the same dipole or quadrupole.
I guess my question is why this, right? So this parameter, you say it's minimal couples and then it recovers curves all the high multiple moments.
Because the curve black hole just, you know, all the multiples moments are just, you know, powers of the dipole.
other stars are also powers of the dipole. It's just with different coefficients.
No, but by powers, I mean, you know, like the expansion of an exponential, you know, with you know, the coefficient being, you know, the coefficients of the exponential, of the expansion of an exponential.
That's
of course, if you change the coefficients, then of course you are talking about a different object.
Okay. Well, I guess what they're describing is a mathematically why it takes that value, but physically I don't know why.
You know, I mean, the scattering amplitude description of the black hole is just, you know, an EFT description.
Yeah.
So you know, at the level of, you know, the Kern metric, you just have a particle with a spin describing your Kern metric, but, you know, you may say, okay, does this hold true for, you know, for higher orders in G, for perturbations of the Kern black hole, and then you can solve for Newman's Penrose scalar, and see, okay, also minimal coupling recovers, you know, minimal coupling amplitudes recover, you know, what's the perturbation of the Kern black hole. So, but it's just an EFT description, and the reason why. Is because of this universality, I'm guessing, but more than that, I wouldn't have anything else to add.
Yeah, well, I guess probably we shouldn't keep people here for this. Probably we can discuss it at a separate time. Yeah, thanks.
Good. So if there are no more questions for the speaker, we can thank Mikhail again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.